Yeah. It's Rational Response Squad. About to hit you in your motherfucking face. It's like they keep telling lies. Why they keep telling lies? Jesus never existed and he's ripping off you guys. You'll read the Jesus puzzle and the faith. Incredible, shrieking son of man. Who testaments to scam like that phony ass Koran. Hit the two around like bands, like that whack ass Benny Hinn, Billy Graham, Kurt Benn. They some sick and twisted men. Why they lying to the people, trying to turn them all to sheep. The Bible simply cruel, all of Nietzsche's shit is deep. With a rational response, we critique the evidence. In 2006, religion has no relevance. Just a sick and twisted dance, trying to take the pain from death. Osama selling virgins, what the fuck do Christians get? An ascetic came to earth just to make you feel like shit. But you can't die for me, no you can't die for me. Look for me like a witch, go ahead and cry for me. Cry for me. Yo. And this goes out to Rook Sapien, Scientific Mike. Nothing but free thoughts transmitting through the night. Evolution is the record for the evidence we fight. Richard Dawkins, Robert Price, trying to set the record right. On the mic, flow precise, anti-gospel, anti-Christ, anti-culture twice. Fuck right-wingers, archetypes. Just a bunch of wicked lies, selling war, selling spies. School of liberties are disguised, why they checking out our lives? Why they can download this track, Patriots Invasion app. We're just trying to fight back, rational and that's a fact. Why they keep telling lies when religion's a disguise to take the pain from death and to govern all the people? I'm asking you the questions in the Inquisition sequel. Most rational people look beyond the good and evil. Most rational people, we look beyond the good and evil. My name is Proclaim once again. Chilling out. The Rational Responders, Mike Rook and Sabian, doing big things. Be on the lookout for the upcoming album, Question Everything. You can find it at ProcleanCreations.com. Once again, this is the Rational Response Squad, bringing it to you live and direct.
Join us right now in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com. If you are listening to our live stream, join us in the chat room at www.rationalresponders.com.
Welcome to the Rational Response Squad. I am Brian Sapient.
I'm Kelly M78.
I'm Yellow Number 5.
And I'm Razor.
And we are the Rational Response Squad. Once again, we are joined this week in a continuing series on Christian fundamentalism in America by the authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. You can purchase the book at newbostonbooks.com as well as rationalresponders.com and through amazon.com. Of course, you can check us out in the chat room at freethoughtmedia.com if you're listening to us when we broadcast our show after The Infidel Guy. And keep in mind, from now on, we broadcast our shows, give you a little behind-the-scenes webcam look in the stick cam room, which goes up on our homepage on recording days. So if you're hanging out with us in the chat room right now in stick cam, about 15 chatters and another 20 listening and watching, thanks a lot. And if you have any questions for any of the guests of the show, please feel free to ask them in the chat room if you are listening live. If you're listening right now Friday after The Infidel Guy, you're not listening live. And, oh, you know what? Check out AtheistNetwork.com, too. AtheistNetwork.com's, where I got started, where I met Rook, and where I got started in my exploration of atheism. So,
hi, Jake.
With us on the line right now is Bobby Kirkhart, Edwin Kagan, Herb Silverman, and John Suarez. If you want to hear some of their biographical information, make sure you listen to the last show that you missed. This show is a continuation of all of the things we were talking about in the last episode about Christian fundamentalism and its dominance in American society. So we'll start off with you today, Bobby. I'm curious, you accuse the fundamentalists of trying to destroy the public schools. Don't you think the public schools have serious problems not related to religion?
Well, of course. Like any malignancy, it attacks weakness. And unfortunately, weakness and strength are combined in periods of change. So in the 1950s, we had Brown versus Board of Education. The Supreme Court said, listen, you've got to educate all of the children, and you've got to take it seriously. And unfortunately, this was a problem to many Americans. They wanted their children educated, but not the people on the other side of the tracks. In the 60s, at about the same time as some of the school prayer rulings, we had an emergent feminist movement. Now, we'd had excellent schools for very little money because an educated woman couldn't get another kind of job, by and large. And all of a sudden, teachers became much more expensive. Teachers today are still underpaid, are still grossly underpaid, but not to the extent we were able to get by with back in the 50s and early 60s. And we had a social revolution that said history and such it has to be the history of the people. And if we're going to teach the beauty of this country, if we're going to instill true patriotism, then our children need to learn that we have corrected our mistakes, that yes, we've been racist, we've been sexist, came later, we've done all kinds of terrible things, but we've learned from our mistakes and we've changed, and this is a country of the people, and this was threatening to a lot of people. So all of these things came together to give the group with the biggest agenda, which is the fundamentalist movement, an opening and a sympathetic ear from a lot of people who were not interested in fundamentalism, but who were dismayed by the public schools becoming the public schools and costing what they were worth.
Can I add to that?
Please do.
Sure.
You know, I echo Bobby's remarks because they're right on the money. However, I think we have to go even beyond that to recognize that our society does not really value public education very much. And the first proof that I offer for that is the fact that the funding for public education is so inadequate that we have had to turn to lotteries to supplement the money available for public education. This is a social shame. Education should be one of our highest goals as a society, and yet we do not recognize such, we do not admit that, and we do not implement it. And I think that we in the humanist and free thinking movement have not done a good enough job, and or at least we should do a better job, to convince society that by failing to educate all of our children, we are really putting the country at risk.
Edwin here, and the current administration is doing everything in their power to destroy the public schools incrementally so that they can then get people to accept vouchers for faith-based education, so they can then send them to the religious schools.
I think the administration's anti-education position derives from two sources. One is religion, and the fact that the public education, as long as you have a viable public education system, it is very difficult for the society to become theocratic. That's one element. The other element is that in terms of corporate greed, I think it's also in their interest not to turn out too many educated people because that would create problems.
Absolutely, ex uno fonte. I think that the corporate greed and greed in general is the wellspring of all of this, that they are using, as one person recently observed in a book who had left the administration, they are using the many evangelicals for their own ends to pull them along in this, just as the Jesuits managed to get a bunch of Protestants who previously had not worried the least about abortion to uphold the infallibility of the Pope by jumping on this anti-abortion thing. And in Brazil, where they got it passed, they made abortion illegal, and they just left and went on their way. And I've heard they in some places actually shoot unwanted children and bring in their bodies for bounty in trucks. I don't know if that's true or not. but they seem to have very little concern for them afterwards.
But I think that our task, which I think we have to become better at, is to convince the society as a whole that if we shortchange education, we're shortchanging the country. We have a huge national debt, and we are really at risk, as has been pointed out by a number of speakers and pundits lately, we're really at risk of rapidly becoming a lesser power, a third world country. And the only way to avoid that, I think, is to bolster education and make sure that we do not lose the underpinnings of how we became a very meaningful society and a very powerful society. We're at the risk of losing that.
That's very true, but given that, then you have the problem of what is an appropriate education. The fundamentalists might well agree with us that we need education, but they want that to be in teaching Noah's Ark and the myths of the Bible, Adam and Eve stories, not critical thinking and evolution. So the kind of thing Richard Dawkins is doing is, in my view, one of the best things that can possibly be done. It needs to be applauded for it.
And some of us here in the Deep South noticed that when schools were required to desegregate, a lot of private schools came up, and then they wanted the government to start giving money to private schools, which quickly turned into religious schools.
Well, and also there's the problem of homeschooling. Now, I don't know about other states, but in Kentucky, if someone signs a child out and says they're going to homeschool them, that is the last the state has any interest in them. They don't check to see what's happened. They don't check on standards, or at least the last time I looked, they do not.
Unfortunately, often the state police come in, as in the Andrea Yates case.
They right, all kinds of horrors.
Yeah.
And I've often wondered how the illiterate Herbert and Pearl think they can homeschool kids when they can't count or read anything beyond my pet goat. You know, how do they think they can talk about the crusades or anything, any type of science, when they don't know it themselves?
Well,
and then they're subjected to fundamentalist literature that they can get that is straight out of the garbage pit of creationism and other mythologies.
Well, I think the homeschooling movement clearly has to do with the fact of allowing the indoctrination of children along the fundamentalist theologies. But it also has the effect of denying those children exposure to the greater world by design. And
that's,
I think,
absolutely correct.
As a society, we ought to take the position that homeschooling is not acceptable. I think that originally homeschooling came into being because there were individual kids who, because of physical or psychological problems, had to be dealt with at home, could not attend the regular school. But I think as a society, we ought to make it clear that an education involves more than just learning to read and do mathematics. Education also involves taking the child out of the home and exposing him to the society around him, and that can only be done in a public school system, and it cannot be done, and in fact it fails, if the child is allowed to remain isolated at home.
Yes, and as John so perceptively observed, that it also produces an ignorant, virtually illiterate electorate who can have anything sold to them. Get an electorate who think that the rapture is an appropriate exit strategy, for example. It's appalling. It really is.
Yeah, I don't think that we should necessarily malign the entire homeschooling movement.
Oh, no, I would not.
There are people out there, myself included, who at some point chose to homeschool because the public schools are pitifully inadequate. And I think that there needs to be some kind of, like, governmental oversight. Like, in the state where I live, Pennsylvania, if you chose to homeschool, that was fine, but you still were accountable to the school district to, you know, show them portfolios, examples of your child's work. You still had to work within a curriculum. And then there were all kinds of programs where you could still have that kind of social contact, like gym, like they would have gym classes. People would get together, you know, two or three times a week to, you know, have their kids socialize. So, I mean, by far, the large majority of people who homeschool do it for religious reasons.
And fundamentalist religious reasons.
Yeah, definitely.
I was going to point out that I know a number of atheist parents who homeschool, some of whom to keep their children from the religion in the so-called secular public school.
Yeah, really.
As an educator, I disagree with that choice. But as an atheist, we have to talk about the importance of keeping educational standards and forcing parents to allow their children to have information however they get it.
Yes, I agree. I mean, like when you look at like the homeschooling, like the curriculums and the different options that you have, so many of them are just openly, blatantly religious, like where children are never ever exposed to a concept like evolution. And clearly we should not tolerate that as a society. But we also touched earlier on the fact that critical thinking skills are just not taught in our education system. And so really, like as a parent, you're kind of forced to choose between like, well, do I want to, you know, give my child like a classical education where I'm going to not teach them to regurgitate the proper answers, but teach them how to discover the answers for themselves? Because you can only do that in your own home unless you have, you know, unlimited amounts of money to spend on the best schools. So, I mean, I think that it's unfortunate that it's, you know, such a dichotomy. But anyway, this leads us into another question that we had for Bobby. So do you think that parents, you know, should have that option to teach their beliefs to their children in whatever way they see fit, including homeschooling? Or do you think that's something that should not be permitted?
No, not in whatever way they see fit. And homeschool is not a way of teaching your beliefs to your children. It's a way of keeping your children, and for religionists, it's very specifically a way of keeping your children from exposure to other beliefs.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
And parents should not have that right. Parents should not. I got an email from someone who, a Christian, who said, you know, I need it. You've ruined the public school and they're giving my child a lot of information.
Oh no, not information.
With my religion. And well, good. I believe it's impractical to say that you can't tell your child, well, if you do this or believe that, you're going to hell. But forbidding parents from doing that might be very appealing. It's a cruel thing to do to a child, but it's an impractical goal. But I think it is practical to insist that all children have access to a variety of information. I certainly raised my atheist child, and I'm sorry, well, Ed Buckner isn't here right now, but we had some discussion about atheist child. My child took the word atheist as soon as she learned it. And I certainly encouraged her to listen to and learn about other points of view. And anyone who has real confidence in their own beliefs should be willing to do that. And anyone who is not willing to do that shouldn't have a choice of keeping their child from the rest of the world. That is child abuse.
Why is it that you think so many parents fail in that regard? Fail to teach their kids essentially how to think and how to learn on their own?
Because they don't know how to do it themselves.
Yes, I think it's a thing that, as Ed is saying, that it's repeated, that it's transmitted from one generation to the next, not via genetics, but via environment.
But, you know, things have changed for the worse in that regard. I think there were parents who were not educated, but once felt the need to have their children be more educated than they were. And I think on subjects like math or English, they might feel that way. But when it comes to issues that they're afraid will conflict with a book written 2,000 years ago, that's when they resist and perhaps want to pull their children out of public education altogether so they can troll the type of what they call education being taught to their children.
And I don't think we should lump all parents' failure in this in the same box. I think that one of the big problems in this country today is people have much less time. And it's a lot easier, takes less time to give your child a timetables chart and say, you study this, than it is to show the child how multiplication works. And, but certainly, and there's court rulings, the Wisconsin case on the Amish. The Amish, as you may know, only send their children through the eighth grade. They teach only arithmetic and mathematics. They teach absolutely no science, very little history, and the teachers are people who have completed the eighth grade. Often the year after they completed, they become teachers. And this was ruled constitutional, and in the Supreme Court ruling, and I don't have it in front of me, so I don't have the exact phrase, it was accepted that to do otherwise would run the risk of the children leaving the parents' religion.
But I think it's up to our educators, our professional educators, to point out a number of things that are important. First, the first 5 years of a child's existence are the most critical. They are the most vulnerable or the most pliable. And those 5 years are more important than any 5 years that follow. And the parents have their first crack at the children by virtue of their being home and with very limited exposure to the outside world. I think, however, that our educational system ought to deliver a clear message that being educated and becoming a citizen and becoming a responsible and productive part of the society involves being exposed to things beyond the home, to other ideas, to expanding their universe, etc. And I think that we're failing to convey that idea that education is more than just the specific subject that could be conceivably taught at home, that education also involves socialization. And to the extent that that doesn't happen, I think the individual suffers and the society suffers. I don't think we're delivering that message clearly enough to everybody today.
Well, I mean, I agree that, you know, giving your child the best education possible, you know, should be of paramount importance for everybody. But sometimes that could potentially be in a home. I mean, it depends on the individual home. You know, I mean, you clearly can't say that every single person who homeschools does it purely because they're trying to prevent their child from having access to information. In some cases, the information that you can give your child and the experiences that you can give your child at home are actually better than what they're going to get in a public school. So, I mean, I think that we need to take the focus away from just saying homeschooling in general and saying homeschooling as a method of preventing your child from having access to that information, you know, because I agree with you 100% that is wrong. I mean, it's clearly not, it shouldn't be acceptable in a society like ours, but there are people who homeschool for, you know, truly, you know, better reasons than that.
I want to make it clear that I didn't mean to. However, I always just go back to my third grade teacher's explanation of what we were doing there. And she taught us, I guess it was my first etymology, A, leading out, education, Duke, leading. Leading out. And that's what education's about. Wherever it happens, it's about giving a child broader choices than he was born to.
And I think that if there are flaws and limitations in the schools, those we ought to put a lot of effort and time and money to correct them, rather than allowing or excusing or promoting alternatives. Again, I'm not sure I would deny any family the right to homeschool, but I certainly would go to great length to point out the problems inherent in that choice, and also I would not allow any funding or support from public money to engage in that activity unless there was a, you know, a good reason to consider it. But I would not, as a matter of fact, agree that's the way to go.
Except even in the public schools, this is Edwin here, in the public schools, democracy having the flaws that it does in some cases, you can get situations like in Kansas where the people voted in a board of education that wanted to teach creationism. We had a similar brush here in Ohio. So that's where you have run into a problem with democracy meeting fundamentalism. With mega churches growing daily, if you want to see how bad it can get, be sure and watch the movie Jesus Camp. If you haven't seen Jesus Camp, be sure to see it.
I did. But however, as a parent, I would take the following position. Let's say that the school that my child is attending is not acceptable, say either because they're teaching things that are ascientific or because they're not teaching them, or for whatever flaws there exist, I would still, unless the conditions were very bad, I would still choose to send my child to that school. And then when he got home at the end of the day, I would supplement, I would revise, I would do what I could to undo whatever limits there were in the school. To not allow that child to go to school would be, for me, an extreme position, and I would consider it only under dire circumstances.
Quite so, but I am National Legal Director for American Atheists, and daily, almost, I receive complaints from all over the country from people whose children are being, in public schools, subjected to prayer in school, forced Bible study, all kinds of things, and it's growing. We have a case in Oklahoma right now in the panhandle of a girl who was kicked off the basketball team of a public school because she refused to join her teammates in reciting the Lord's Prayer at the end of the game. They made up other excuses, of course, but that was what it was really about. And this is unprecedented, and it's coming about, in my view, because of an attitude in this country that permits it and encourages it.
Right, but the answer to that awful situation is not to cave in and take the child out of that setting.
Well, I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting that, John. I'm just telling you how bad the situation is
getting.
I don't think you should take the kid out of school. I think people need to raise some fuss. What troubles me is the amount of people who think it's perfectly okay to do what the fundamentalists are doing. And that is the danger of fundamentalism in America.
And this is the challenge to us to do a better job of educating the society as a whole, which is an uphill battle, no question. But this is where our book is, you know, our 2 cents worth in terms of leading that fight.
Oh, has anybody mentioned that our book has been translated into Arabic?
Yes, it was mentioned earlier.
Okay,
I think.
Fine.
Yeah, and
although,
you know,
that's I still recommend the English version to most of the people.
Yes, 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 and it's far better than the movie, right?
Right.
Guys, each one of these questions we could go on for hours, and in fact, I think we've all kind of agreed here that maybe individually we should have you back on the show at a later time. We want to move past the schooling questions, though, and get back into some other stuff. And John, this question is for you. Some would say that the free exercise and establishment clause are in inherent conflict with one another. Could you give us your thoughts here?
Yeah. I think the free exercise and the establishment clauses are two perspectives on the same issue, namely the very complicated relationship between not church and state, but more correctly, as Bobby said earlier, between religion and government. The free exercise clause looks at it from the point of view of the individual or the group and sees to it that group has freedom of religion, freedom to worship, to do whatever they want or not worship, and that's the protection allowed by the free exercise. The Establishment Clause looks at it from the point of view of the limitations of government in terms of promoting religion. Now, you can create a scenario, and it's not very difficult at all, and we've had many examples, where the two seem to be in conflict. For example, say a teacher in a public school who wants to set aside a minute during class time to lead the class in prayer. From the free exercise point of view, if that's all that existed, she certainly would have the right to do that. From the Establishment Clause position, obviously she is using her position as a government agent to proselytize and promote religion, which of course the Establishment Clause does not allow. And if pitted one against the other in that setting, I think most of us would agree that the Establishment Clause should supersede the free exercise clause in not allowing that particular activity to take place. But if you look at the Establishment Clause more broadly, you will see that it is really designed to protect freedom of expression in the free exercise clause, because by denying that teacher the right to lead the class in a particular sectarian prayer, we are really protecting the viability of all religions or no religion in denying her to the chance to do that, and thus preserve the right of everyone to proceed as they see fit without being coerced into a particular religious perspective. So, in effect, what I tell people is that the Establishment Clause is the best defense, the best protector of the Free Exercise Clause. And once you see it in that light, I think you can be comfortable with both clauses and at the same time appreciate the incredible wisdom of the Founding Fathers in setting it up in that manner. And in, you know, triggering what I call the 200-year experiment of separation of government and religion, which was really a very new idea that had not been tried before, and I think we are the beneficiaries of that experiment.
Well, and if Edward, the constitutional lawyer on the panel, could be permitted a footnote there, I think what it means in summary is that you have the right to exercise your religion so long as you don't do it in the public square or in the public forum. That's the way to look at it. You can have all the manger scenes you want and crutches and whatnot on your own lawn or in your own church. Just don't put it on the public square or the public school. That's the easiest way, okay?
Would either of you see the organized recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of the school day, especially the pledge as it's currently written, would you see that as a violation of the Establishment Clause?
Of course it's a violation. When it said previously, when I was in school, the pledge said one nation indivisible. The moment you put it and modify it, one nation under God indivisible, you make the country divisible, as witnessed by all of the flap going on about it. And if it's not religious, why not just take it out? You know, of course it's religious. How would it
is religious.
What?
It is religious, and it is a violation of the First Amendment.
Of course
and
it
I
is.
Think, and most people are not aware that was not the way the pledge was written originally.
That's right, it was written by a minister who didn't put that in there.
What can we do to, you know, I mean, I know Michael Newdell's working on that, but is there anything else we can do to help correct that?
It harks back to the issue of trying to educate people as to the wisdom of the First Amendment and the fact that it's a fairly empty effort to introduce God in that context. It doesn't advance anything of value, and it creates divisiveness, which is what the First Amendment was very desperately trying to avoid.
We need civics taught. People don't know how their government works. When you hear representatives in the Congress and Senate of the United States saying things like the legislature has to retake control of the courts, this is truly frightening. The legislature never had control of the courts. and they say to restore America to being a Christian nation. It was never a Christian nation to begin with, never set up on biblical principles. Democracy is not mentioned in the Bible, and it has a system of judges and kings, not democracy. The word doesn't appear, nor does the concept. So it is not that way, and many people don't know that. They believe it because it's being shouted at them by TV preachers or after their money.
I'm pledging $10 to Ed right now.
Just buy copies of the book. Give out copies of my book in school. There's some songs and poems in there, and you can use it for a hymnal.
Okay.
You can use the song, "They're Back in Their Burkas Again."
Edwin, how did the how did the Mayflower Compact figure into the founding of America?
It did not, and thank you for asking. We hear constantly, they don't mind lying, they don't mind, it doesn't matter to them what they say. The Mayflower Compact, was signed in 1620, long before the United States was formed. A fellow by the name of Oliver, if you really don't know why we should have separation of church and state, let's look at this situation. Oliver Cromwell took over the government of England, executed the king, and set up the Puritan system of government. When they were finally thrown out, and Charles II brought back from France, who was in exile as king of England, it was known as the Restoration. The Puritans packed up and went to various other countries, Denmark and so on, and were kicked out of every civilized country in Europe, and finally boarded a ship called the Mayflower and came here. That's a vast oversimplification, to be sure. But on the Mayflower, let me get this for you. It does say, "In the name of God, amen, we whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord King James," a homosexual, by the way, "by the grace of God of England, France and Ireland, King, Defender of the Faith, etc., having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these presents solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one of another covenant and combine ourselves into a civic body politic," blah, blah, blah. Okay, now, what is seldom noted is the document was signed by only 41 of the 102 passengers on the Mayflower, and 37 of those were separatists who were supposedly fleeing religious persecution in Europe. What they meant by fleeing religious persecution was the right to go and persecute others for not following their beliefs. This is all very nicely set out in the play The Crucible, if you ever have the opportunity to see that. But the First Amendment and the Constitution and Article 6, which says there shall never be any religious test for any office under this Constitution, were specifically and deliberately put in there to avoid things like the statements of the Mayflower Compact. Our nation was set up consciously and purposefully as a secular society, and the word secular means without religion. The word God is not mentioned in the Constitution and in the year of our Lord as a way of dating things, like 206 A.D. Is that enough on the Mayflower Compact?
Yes, sir.
It has none. Nor does the Declaration of Independence, by the way, have anything to do with the founding of our country. The country was founded with the Constitution after much debate, and it was decided and set up as a godless document. And even in the Declaration of Independence, it ends, "We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, not to any god or any supernatural system."
I have a suggestion to promote the word and the concept secular, and that is to begin to mispronounce it, just as somebody prominent in Washington misspeaks nuclear and says nuclear. I think that we should start saying secular, and then when people that will attract attention and we can focus more on secular.
Or maybe even better.
John, I thought you were going to suggest we say sexier.
Yeah,
sexier.
Yes,
we are sexier.
I didn't have enough wine yet to get to sexual. So secular will do for now. Yeah.
Edwin and Bobby, this question's for both of you, but I'd like Bobby to go first. Why is the United States one of the most religious nations on earth? Or, as we now learned, it's one of the least sexular nations on earth. So, but no, seriously, why are we one of the most religious nations on earth, Bobby?
Okay. We didn't get here for only one reason, certainly. It's often pointed out that the variety of religions, it makes religion market, whereas the state established church got lazy, depends on the tax money and such. And that's true. I mean, turn on your TV. Religion is marketing to you all the time. But I also think the variety of religion gives people a lot of choices. If you grow up in the Lutheran Church in Sweden, and you decide to leave the Lutheran Church, you don't buy what they're telling you. There's not 150 people trying to catch you. There's nobody saying, come join our Buddhist colony, or no, you really should be a Baptist, or the Catholics have it right. So you just kind of logically, and I use the word advisedly, go to the default position of no religion. But there's another reason that is almost always overlooked. We certainly, in the rest of the world, religion, and to a lesser extent here, religion is associated with poverty. And it's very easy to see why poor people are more vulnerable to religion. They may be less educated, and we've talked about that. But more than anything, they're terribly insecure. They need a friend. They need something to depend on. And in this country, unlike the other developed democracies, we have no national health insurance. We have very weak labor law and such. And this is not a political statement. Perhaps that's a good thing. Though I wouldn't think so, but this is, Americans are terribly insecure. And on Christ the solid rock I stand, the whole old hymn goes. Americans need the security that they think religion will give them.
Edwin, feel free to jump in there. Do you have anything else to add?
Okay. The Roman writer Cicero, I think it was, said something, an exact quote, something to the effect of that fools find religion true, wise people find it false, and rulers find it useful. Yeah. And that is absolutely correct. It is. You were talking earlier, there was talk about kings and priests, religion. Someone said that freedom will only come when the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest, or vice versa. I have to get some scholar to answer that. But I think we are truly seeing the vestiges of the Puritans. They planted in the soil, and it's continued. Now, when I said that America was not founded as a Christian nation, that does not mean that Americans are not Christian. Americans are overwhelmingly Christian, I would say. And yet the founding documents were set up so that there is no official religion, and they knew perfectly well from the experiences with Cromwell and other similar matters that when you tried to have an official religion, there was bloodshed. In this country, there was blood running in the streets between the Baptists and the Anabaptists. Thomas Jefferson was written a letter by the Danbury, Connecticut Baptists asking him just what the First Amendment meant, and he said it in fact creates a wall of separation between church and state. The Baptists at that time were the persecuted minority. So the people who think we should not have separation of church and state only think that so long as they're on top. The constitutional rights enumerated in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, are not designed to protect the majority. The majority doesn't need protecting. But when the people who are now in power, if they are ever replaced by, let's say, how about the Mormons or Islamic groups, by Jewish groups, by whatever, then you will hear them yelling for separation of church and state. Love it or leave it, as they used to say during the 70s sarcastically. That's the way it is. If you want to go to a country where you can persecute non-believers at will, go to Bosnia or something like that, but you're not being a very good American. And indeed, it smacks to me of treason to try to argue a state religion. To say that America is founded as a Christian nation is establishing a religion.
Go ahead, Herb.
I've had some cases where they say posting the Ten Commandments in public schools and public, well, that's not religion. Having prayer and Bible reading, that's not religion. Well, how would it look if it was religious? You know, how would it look if they were trying to establish a religion?
Right. Go ahead, Herb. You had a point.
Herb always got a point.
Yeah, that wasn't me, but I can certainly make a point in terms of following up on Edwin's comment about posting the Ten Commandments. One should note that the First Commandment, thou shalt have no other gods, conflicts with the First Amendment, which gives you the right to have one, many, or no gods.
Oh, all kinds of conflicts. And by the way, if anybody really needs the Ten Commandments, I have thoughtfully posted them on my website at www.edwinkagan.com, where they can be printed out, compliments of Kentucky atheists, and put in the front of your binder and taken to school so that when your classmates come intent to murder their fellow classmates with semi-automatic weapons, they can read it, thou shalt not kill, and say, oh, we must not do this, and return to their homes.
Going back to the original question about the degree of religiosity in the United States always and today, I think there is a contrast between the United States and, say, Western Europe and even to some extent Latin America. We have sociologically, we tend to be very skittish about both the issue of politics and religion, in that both topics are typically taboo subjects for everyday discussion. For example, it's always fascinating to me that socialism is a dirty word in the United States, whereas it is a standard, you know, political option in Europe. The same way with religion. We tend to be very reluctant to criticize religion, to do comparative analyses, etc. I think that we are developing or evolving more slowly vis-a-vis Western Europe, say, because of our reluctance to talk about things openly and without pre-existing prejudices.
Once again, folks, you are tuned into the Rational Response Squad. We are speaking today with the co-authors of a book called The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America. The editor and originator of that book was Kimberly Blaker, who joined us in last week's episode. Please check out the book, buy a copy, Amazon.com, and also visit us at rationalresponders.com and help us out. We currently have an essay contest underway, which we're trying to get a lot of submissions, views from the atheistic community so we can widely represent the views of atheists on our message board, and we're going to create a large library for your thoughts, but we haven't had that many submissions yet. We're trying to do essays such as an essay called I Am Every Atheist, in which you'll be able to write about what makes you an atheist. And, you know, there's a lot of people, we talked about it in a recent episode, how some atheists are defined by what they don't believe as opposed to what they do believe. And so we'd like you to take the opportunity to talk about what you do believe and what makes you atheist and who you are. And as we read all the different essays, we'll notice some similarities between all of them, but we'll also see many differences between them, which I think is nice, and it'll give us a chance to unite under some common grounds and also to open up some dialogue. And we have a bunch of other essays that we're trying to get, so check that out by visiting the essay contest portion of our message board. And we're also trying to get you to create flyers for our activist campaigns like the Perpetual Enlightenment and the mockery of Fox News, the War on Christmas. So definitely participate in those. And back to the show here, Edwin and Bobby, this question is for both of you. Again, this time, Edwin, please go first.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on how an individual or nations can be moral if they do not have a religious base?
Well, if they feel they need the Bible or religious base so they don't kill, murder, or steal, right, they ought to go right on being religious. It's absolutely preposterous. There's nothing of any morality in the Bible. In my book, Bibles of Blasphemy, I have an essay titled On Genital-Based Morality. Whenever moralists talk about morality, they're talking about sexual behavior. They're not talking about kindness. They're not talking about any of the things Jesus mentioned in the Sermon on the Mount. They are talking about sexual conduct. I've also prepared a rather large collection of biblical quotes titled, They Shall Bruise the Tits of Their Virginity and Other Family-Friendly Bible Quotes for Atheists. The Bible is a horror story of rapes, adulteries. How is it considered a work of morality? But I digress. To answer your question, moral codes evolve. We learn as a society we can't permit people to go out killing people randomly or someone might kill us. So therefore we prohibit it. And we prohibit it through a system called law. And that has evolved. There are primitive more legal codes and there are more advanced ones. The United States has recently been regressing and going back to more primitive moral codes and legal codes. But there is no people who say that they need a book or a tablet or some kind of set of rules to be good are kind of scary, because what if somebody changes those rules? And then you know, again, back to our priests who like to rape children for fun or profit or whatever. Are these the moral guides? Are these the paragons of virtue? If gold rusts, what will iron do? What is the evidence that religion makes anyone moral? There are very few born-again atheists on death row, whereas there are all sorts of born-again Christians. We have examples of David Koresh and Jim Jones of murders of human beings in the name of religion. The wars going on now and the crusades of the past, the inquisitions of the Christian church, the burnings, the hangings of human beings, the murder of them in the name of religion. What morality is this? Where is the morality they claim to derive from their religion?
For more on this morality issue as well, before we get to your thoughts, Bobby, check out AskTheAtheist.com. Jake from the Atheist Network did a YouTube video on where atheists get their morals from, and I think that you'll enjoy that. And don't forget to check out our sponsor, EvolveFish.com. EvolveFish, of course, is the home of the EvolveFish, a rational response to the Jesus Fish. Of course, they have shirts and hats and mugs and bumper stickers as well. And when you display your atheistic pride, you'll likely bump into other freethinkers that you never even realized were freethinkers. So,
and a lot of Christians.
And Gary and Becky are very nice people. Gary and Becky.
Evolved Fish is the first stop on my Christmas shopping. Back to the question. I had a number of really frustrating discussions with conservative religionists on this issue, where they seemed to be completely impervious to all of the wonderful facts that Edwin was reciting. Until I read George Lakoff, Moral Politics. And he points out that there are two basic philosophies of where we get our morality. And nobody may be 100% in one camp or another, but a lot of us are fairly extremely in one or another. And one, and the fundamentalist certainly is in this camp, is that morality comes from obedience. And it's almost always a religious concept, because everyone must obey. The child obeys the mother obeys the father obeys the minister obeys God, or depending on the hierarchy of the church, there may be more middlemen. And this is, for some people, and for the extreme fundamentalists, this is morality. And obedience is the only way to be moral. And whatever you do, however good it may be, if it's not obedient, it's not good. It's not moral. For most free thinkers and a lot of religionists, morality comes from consensus. how do we best make things work? How do we make the most people happy? And I would argue that leaders of the nations, of course, get a lot of traction out of the obedience morality. Today, most of the country is deciding the war in Iraq was a mistake. But long after there were no weapons of mass destruction, people supported the war under the obedience morality. I suggest that, that's very convenient for our political leaders, but modern morality and the morality of a democracy has to depend on the morality of coalition and consensus.
Yeah, and Bobby is so correct. It is control. It's control, control. You may say sarcastically that religion started when the first con artist met the first fool. When, the first con artist says to fool, I get the vibes from the gods and I can tell you what it is. Now, if you presume that you can only live a moral life by the interpretation of the will of the God, who interprets that? There are hundreds of different denominations. Who is right? The one who interprets it is the decider, the one who has the power ordained by God to tell you what to do. And therein lies the power and the control and the danger of religion.
May I add to that? Ethics and morality are ultimately an individual issue. That is, regardless of what the social or religious mores are, it is the individual who has to incorporate a guidelines for ethics and morality, and the individual who thinks for himself is able to develop a system which is practical and adaptable and meaningful, but which also is subject to tuning and revision and tweaking as his experience and maturing allows. At the other end of the spectrum, we have the authoritarian individual who abdicates thinking for himself and merely incorporates a set of standards uncritically, and then, of course, finds himself, if he will allow himself, to realize that there are discrepancies, conflicts, contradictions, which he then is not really able to deal with and sort of, you know, looks the other way.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask John. John's a psychiatrist, right? Maybe you could tell me this. How do priests rationalize that they are moral people doing the will of God while they're raping the little boys? How do they work that out in their little minds?
Denial is a fantastically effective psychological mechanism.
Not just a river.
Denial allows you to push aside, out of awareness, anything you want, and therefore continue thinking and believing and acting in any way you wish.
Are you saying they're not aware that they're raping the little boys when they're doing
it? Well, they are, but they do it anyway. So that
what does father get for oral sex? They said a quarter and a bag of potato chips.
So the point is this: every individual, all of us, are capable of justifying anything, and I think the ability to do that is there. The ability to employ it depends on our own consciousness, on our own conscience, on our own maturity, on our own self-honesty. And so that, it happens. And the fact that it happens means that it's possible. It's regrettable, but it's there. We have to live with it. Denial is something available to all of us, and we all employ it to some degrees when we overdo it.
And would that be true of the sheep whose shepherd goes and rapes the little boys? Are they denying that, or how are the congregations dealing with that?
No, denying in the sense that the problem is it's denied to the extent that the awareness of the wrongdoing is sufficient to stop the behavior. And so the denial somehow allows it with varying degrees of guilt and discomfort.
Can I come in for a minute? One thing in terms of denial, when, you know, obviously abominable acts take place, most people of all religions say, well, that's just an aberration. Those who still say they follow biblical-based morality.
If it's done by an atheist, though, they say, see, that's the way atheists are.
But, you know, one thing I think all Christians seem to have in common, whether liberal or conservative or anything in between, is saying, well, those others aren't true Christians because they don't behave the same way. So when you're talking about a biblical-based morality, even those who want to follow it, there are really no clear guidelines. It's a matter of interpretation, and they use, in a lot of ways, situation ethics just as humanists and atheists do.
The morality may vary from ours. Take, for example, the attitude or acceptance of homosexuality. If you believe that it is immoral, then it goes on to justify any action, no matter how savage or cruel, to justify your basic moral. So morality, as much as they would like it to be believed, is not written in stone. It's a very evolving, and it varies from one person to the next.
Right, and I think just in case there are any theists out there who do need to believe in an invisible man in the sky in order to refrain from killing me and from robbing me and from raping me, if you need that, please keep believing. Please don't ever stop believing because you scare me. But moving on from that point, unbeknownst to a lot of people here, we have our own token Christian here at the Rational Response Squad. We keep her chained in the yard. We occasionally require her blood for our pagan rituals. And she has a question for Bobby.
Her name is Christy the Christian.
Yes, yes. Christy would
like
to know.
Some of my best friends are Christians. Don't be putting them Christians.
She'd like to know, aren't you guys really just a bunch of atheists against all religions?
Well, yeah, we talked a little bit about that on the last show. Most of us probably have disagreement with all religion, philosophical disagreement. As we've been discussing, religion is really, really a poor way to arrive at ethics. And that's a philosophical field. What is ethical? And religion is very poor logically. But I don't oppose what the Presbyterian Church does because I think that they may be illogical, or I think that the way they come to their ethics may be flawed. The book is about fundamentalism. The book is about those religionists who are trying to impose their religion on the rest of us. And this is when any belief becomes evil. It doesn't have to be religion. Any dogma that says it has to be followed by the whole society is wrong. It's wrong, it's evil, and that's where my blood boils and where my true opposition comes up.
And if I may, you said earlier something about why you're an atheist. This is not looking at it the right way. Everybody is born an atheist. All people are born atheists without any idea of God at all until it is poured into their little heads. This is why in the near-death experiences, people in one religion will have near-death experiences comporting with the gods of their religion. And Christians will see Jesuses, and I suppose Hindus will see Brahmins at the end of the tunnel of light as the brain is dying. But one is born an atheist. Sorry about that.
No, Edwin, that's fine. And in fact, you know, and that's interesting that you bring that up because we would all agree here. You know, just for the record, what you're referring to is the I Am Every Atheist essay request contest. And in fact, that's the type of thing that we're looking for people to write in their essay. If you were to submit an essay, that's exactly what you could write. Well, I am every atheist because I was born atheist, you know, and so.
Yeah, I was born atheist, but I became president and minister and I had to come back.
No, but we're asking people to submit essays to us, the Rational Response Squad. And obviously we speak out against what we think are dangers of religion. There are other atheists out there who don't. And, you know, they say, well, you know, I don't want to participate in your contest. So look, you know, you might disagree with the stance that we take and the proactive role that we play and the fact that we speak out. And you should include that in your essay. I am every atheist. You're every atheist because you keep your mouth shut. You know, you're every atheist because you are an apatheist or because you are a live and let live. So, I mean, every atheist is different. The only common thread that we have to have between us is that we all lack belief in a God. So that's the type of thing that we're looking for from the community, is all these different varying views of why, what is atheism to you and who you are and things like that. So
I'd like to make a point about what we are when we're born, but let me preface that by saying that most of the adjectives that begin with the letter A are really unfortunate. That goes for atheist. I am an A Santa Clausian because I don't believe in Santa Claus. I'm an A Sardinian because I don't like sardines in my Caesar salad. But those are negative precepts. The best way to define myself is that I'm a free thinker, namely that I think or hope that I arrive at what I believe, what I think, the way I put things together through rational, scientific, critical thinking methods. And so I much prefer the term free thinker, which among other things, it gets people to say, what are you? When they're asking about my socio-political religious, and I say, I'm a free thinker, and they say, oh, what's that? And it gives me a chance to explain. Whereas atheists would just, you know, have them shut up and walk away. But when I was trained medically and biologically, it was believed that the brain was fully formed at birth. It obviously had the capacity to grow, but without change. It was formed. We have since learned that the brain is capable, certainly undergoes a lot of change, a lot of adjustment in the early years, and it's capable of adjusting and redesigning itself in a way, even into old age like ours. And so to say that one is born an atheist or no, one is born with pretty much a clean slate. And how that brain develops, how it gets wired, depends very much in one's early experiences and exposures. If you are taught, those of us who have the good fortune to be born in a household, in a setting where thinking and reason and analysis and critical thinking were paramount, grew up in that direction. Those of us who were exposed to certain dogmas, 98-99% grew up that way, with obviously a small percentage down the line saying, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense, I think I'm going to give it up, which is the exception, not the rule. We're really not born anything. And so I think that what happens in those early years determines very much how we grow up, what we grow up thinking and believing, and that's the way it is. And it's very hard to undo. Dawkins, I haven't read the God Delusion, but in some of his earlier essays, talked about the early brain being wired akin to a computer to believe certain things and to reject other things. And I think that's a wonderful analogy because that's exactly what happens. It is that early brain that responds to exposure to the environmental factors, which gets wired, and after which it's very hard to undo.
On that note, we need to allow Bobby off the line so we can get Ed back in the fray, as we previously discussed. And we'll take a brief commercial break and go ahead and do that. And Bobby Kirkhart, thanks so much for joining us. And we're going to direct as many people as we can to secular.org to support the Secular Coalition for America. And thanks so much for all the work that you're doing there.
Bowling for Columbine did it to the gun culture. Supersize Me did it to fast food. Now the God who wasn't there does it to religion. Holding modern Christianity up to a bright spotlight, this bold and often hilarious new film asks the questions few dare to ask. Your guide through the world of Christendom is former fundamentalist Brian Fleming, joined by such luminaries as Jesus Seminar fellow Robert Price, Professor Richard Dawkins, author Sam Harris, and historian Richard Carrier. See the movie the Los Angeles Times calls provocative, to put it mildly. Hold on to your faith. It's in for a bumpy ride. Purchase The God Who Wasn't There at www.rationalresponders.com.
This is Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation, and you are listening to the Rational Response Squad.
The Rational Response Squad is your voice of rational thought online. Please subscribe today at www.rationalresponders.com for access to all of their shows.
Thanks for listening to the Rational Response Squad. This spot would be the perfect place for you to advertise your free thought-related business or organization. With rates as low as 2 cents per listener, we blow away the advertising competition. Furthermore, what better way to spread the word than to support an organization fighting to free humanity from the mind disease known as theism? Send a message to rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com to learn about our rates. Again, that's rationalresponsesquad@hotmail.com. Your ad could be right here in next week's episode.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney. In my new play, Letting Go of God, I come out clearly as an atheist, absolutely committed to keeping church and state separate. Won't you join me and the Freedom From Religion Foundation in waking up America to the growing dangers of theocracy? Phone 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. That's ffrf.org.
Hi, this is Steve Gregg, and you're listening to the so-called Rational Response Squad.
Again, with the co-authors of the book, The Fundamentals of Extremism, The Christian Right in America, we last let Bobby Kirkhart go so that we could bring Ed Buckner back into the conversation. Dr. Ed, thanks a lot for coming back on.
Well, thank you for having me back. I'm looking forward to it.
John,
as long as I get to bug Edwin Kagan.
Yeah. Yes, definitely, definitely.
I ratted you out and told him you were the editor of Bobbles of Blasphemy.
John, I've got a pretty important question for you, and I've got a feeling you're not going to give me the answer I want. But hey, I'm up for it. So let me ask you. Most people are not willing to believe the stories of others without some sort of proof. Yet religion often gets a free proof pass. It seems that oftentimes people can become extremely closed off to embracing sound logic where they might otherwise be able to embrace it everywhere else in life. As a former professor of psychiatry, I'm curious if you think it's anywhere near accurate to equate any of this with a mental disorder. And by the way, nobody actually listens to the show, so feel free to speak candidly.
Okay. Well, I thought that listening to this show over the last several days and the last several programs would really make an impact on our society, and that's why we all agreed to participate. So don't sell it short. But returning to your question, we talked earlier at another time about denial. There are the issue, as speaking as a former mental health professional, has to do really with anxiety, with discomfort. Anxiety is probably one of the most uncomfortable experiences that a human being can have. It surpasses pain and other things in terms of being able to tolerate it. And there are two issues that are very troublesome to us humans. One has to do with, you know, trying to understand the universe around us and where we fit and how much of a part we play in it. And the other one has to do with what happens to us after death. We're all aware that death is an event in life, and on superficially it seems to be the end. And nobody likes that possibility. So in order to, religion has provided very persuasive, reassuring answers to both issues, both the nature of the universe and our place in it, as well as what happens after death and the whole issue of immortality. Our brains, as capable as they are not committed solely to reason and rationality and critical thinking. And the brain's reserve a part of the psyche, because it's really not a biological part or segment, but it's really part of the psyche that allows to accommodate and compartmentalize thoughts that under any other circumstance would be discarded. If we were trying to fix a motor that's not working right or solve a problem in mathematics, we would rely and promote reason and critical thinking. But those things do not really work in terms of soothing our anxiety. And so we have, the brain has, at our level of development, has the capacity to have a little bit of denial, a little bit of acceptance of things that are not rational, do not make sense in any other context, but which will provide us reassurance and the soothing of anxiety if we accept it. Now that capacity varies from one person to the next. I think there are times when free thinkers wish that they could believe because, you know, at times they're frightened, at times they're confused, at times they're not capable to overcome their commitment to reason. And so they remain somewhat anxious and find other ways to cope with it. But basically, that's the way our brains are. They're not 100% rational machines or computers. As to the issue of whether believing in religion or being a theist is per se a mental illness, that very much depends on how you define it. It's a semantical issue. Because if you define illness as being away from the norm, being unusual, then of course, since 85-90%, whatever the percentage is, of people who are willing to suspend critical thinking to in order to be able to believe, then they are clearly the majority, and in most societies they have been the majority. If on the other hand you define mental illness as a set of functioning mechanisms that interfere with your everyday existence, you know, whether you're paranoid or obsessive or whatever, to the extent that your psychic mechanisms are getting in the way of everyday living and everyday enjoyment, that's how the more pragmatic definition of mental illness. And what religious people have found, and they do it very, very well, is that they compartmentalize their irrational thoughts and their religious thoughts and can function in most instances, in most contexts very well, even though this compartment is still part of their psyche. In that way, their religion is not actively interfering with their everyday activities, and therefore we'd be hard pressed to call that illness. Obviously, when there are instances, of course, where the religious, the religiosity begins to invade all aspects of their everyday activities, and at that point, by virtue of the disruption, we might consider illness. But it's really a semantical issue, and no matter how we define it or what we conclude here in this panel, I don't think we're going to alter the percentages of people who are believers versus non-believers out in the society. This is really one of the amazing things, that even though we have committed ourselves so much to critical thinking and science, etc., it is amazing that we have had so relatively little impact on religious belief, even into the 21st century.
Okay, so you're saying it's a disorder that can only be cured by subscribing to the Rational Response Squad.
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it a disorder, but I certainly will write a prescription for signing up for our organization.
How significant do you think the role is of the judiciary in interpreting the First Amendment?
That's a rapid segue from one issue to the next. I've taught a number of courses on the First Amendment, and one of the questions that I pose my students, not the first day, but along halfway along the course, is I read them the 16 words of the First Amendment that deal with religion and government, and I ask the question, what do these things mean? What does this cluster of words mean? And they come up with all sorts of things. And of course, the punchline, the answer I'm seeking is, those words mean whatever the U.S. Supreme Court says they mean, which is, I think, the answer to your question. The judiciary have a significant, a major role in interpreting and reinterpreting the First Amendment. I think there was very little interpretation of the First Amendment until, I would say, the middle of the 20th century. And then we begin to get a lot of cases, one after the other, some of them in conflict with previous decisions, etc. And for the most part, I think those of us in the panel today would say that most of the decisions have gone the correct way. That is, protecting the separation of church and state, or religion and government, and protecting the integrity of the wall, as Jefferson called it, between the two. I think that there has been a trend in the last 10 or 15 years, even before the current administration, that has begun to poke holes in that wall. And there are a number of decisions that have moved us away from strict separation. And of course, what we have to fear is the fact that 90% of the judiciary in place today were named by Bush Sr., Reagan, and Bush Jr. And of course, who knows what's to come in the coming years.
Oh, Jeb Bush and then Bush daughters.
I'm sorry?
Jeb Bush and then Bush daughters.
Right.
They come next.
And so that I am very concerned. The simple answer to your question, the judiciary play a great role, and therefore I am very concerned about the short-term and long-term fate of separation in the coming years.
All right, and this won't be as an abrupt of a segue. What is civil religion?
I think the concept of civil religion is a creation. I view it as a way of rationalizing a number of religious practices that society has been engaging in, which are clearly in conflict with the First Amendment, but which they're not willing to let go or change. For example, having In God We Trust in the currency, or starting a session of Congress with a prayer, and a number of other things where religion is inserted, and when criticized, most people have been willing to accept it or rationalize it by saying, well, that's not true religion, which I don't understand at all, but it's really civil religion. It's part of the tradition. It's not really religion, and it's not really an assault on the First Amendment. I disagree, but I think that's how most people have explained it or defined it.
Had a quick follow-up.
Please.
Before we let you go here, it's actually on the judiciary issue. It was Justice Scalia came out, I think it was like last week or so. He essentially said that, well, in his opinion, that the abortion issue wasn't one that the court should be addressing, and that those who are in favor of allowing a woman to choose have basically done ourselves a disservice, because we're going to regret it when a more conservative court takes the bench. What is your feeling on that?
Well, I think, unfortunately, he's predicting the future. I think that a number of rulings pertaining directly to the First Amendment and indirectly to religion in general, abortion being the one at issue that you're asking now, I think those decisions are very much in danger, because the conservatives in the court have no commitment whatsoever to precedent. They are committed to their own ideology, and they will change any decision that we have been living with to suit their ideology, and they will not hesitate to change it on the basis that it, in their view, it's the correct thing to do. So I am very worried about a number of things that we have come to accept as part of our society, part of our judicial ideology, which I think will be very rapidly changing. I think the Supreme Court, which was very, very carefully balanced, a few years ago, every appointment from here on is going to really tilt it in a particular way toward conservatism, and I think we're going to see a lot of decisions at all levels, but a lot of issues that we have come to accept as the way to interpret the First Amendment that will be radically changed.
And well, on a downer, why don't you?
Since I'm going to be going off shortly, my fellow panelists will pick up and provide some optimism, I hope.
Yes. In fact, John, we will let you go. We know you want to get back to your family. So thanks so much for joining us on this series, and hopefully we'll have you back on the show again someday.
Well, thank you for the idea of this panel, and I wish you well as well.
All right, John.
Bye-bye, all.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So now Edwin and Ed have to pick on each other.
Yeah, well,
that's and Herb can pick on both.
And yes, and yeah, Herb can question their motives.
Just a battle of the
odds. What would do for you?
Well, you know what, Edwin? Let me ask you a question. In fact, let me ask you a couple questions.
Okay.
What's your favorite what's your favorite feature about Ed Buckner? Or you know what? Or you know, let me stop there. What do you love most about Dr. Buckner?
The totality of his multifaceted abilities of personality.
Okay, all kidding aside.
He's a remarkable individual. He and I are both Presbyterian minister sons, okay?
No. I'm an Episcopalian minister son.
Oh, my God, heretic? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's right. Yes, I did. Okay. I told you earlier that Presbyterians think that Methodists or Baptists you can read. Right? Okay.
Edwin, you know, we've been talking about religious fundamentalism here for hours now. I mean, really? Tell us, what exactly is fundamentalism?
Okay. It's hard to really define. I hate to tell you that, but the term comes from a series of pamphlets that were published, fundamentalist pamphlet series in 1910 and so on. And there are really five major points that they emphasized. One, the verbal inspiration of the Bible, dictated by God, essentially. Two, the virgin birth of Christ. Three, the substitutionary atonement of Christ. Four, the bodily resurrection of Christ. And five, the second coming of Christ. Now, those who believed those things were known as fundamentalists. And that's basically what it means. There are other things involved, such as, I think today that when we speak of fundamentalists, we're referring to the following characteristics: a belief in biblical inerrancy or a literal interpretation of the Bible, that they practice separation from non-believers, and then they act specifically for imposing religion and Christian-based ideas on society. They attribute most of everything in life to divine intervention. You know, in other words, the tsunamis because God's mad because the gay pride march in California or something. They practice evangelism, that's going out and converting people, emphasizing end times and the second coming of Christ, and they are authoritarian in nature and hold their absolute truths in all issues regardless of circumstances. They don't want to have any truck with that situational morality stuff that liberals like you like to put out, okay? Now, that in a nutshell is what fundamentalism is. Would you agree, Dr. Buckner, sir?
Well, you would have to add, and it's related to this authoritarian part you talked about.
Didn't I just put that in, say that? Yes, they're very authoritarian.
You didn't use that word. But
I didn't. Okay, they are. They are.
And that they believe obedience is a moral plus, a big one, maybe the main.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, watch the movie Jesus Camp if you want to see. Now, I understand even the fundamentalists are outraged by this movie because it makes them look so bad. Well, you know, I didn't create the facts. What they're doing is bad, and I agree with what was said earlier, that what they are doing is essentially child abuse. And I hope they do sue me for slander, because truth is a defense.
I got a question for Ed Buckner.
Fire away.
Ed, why should someone who believes, as most fundamentalists apparently do, that God's judgment and commands are in every respect perfect, except separation of church and state?
That is, in fact, a core question. This book we've been talking about, The Fundamentals of Extremism, responds to that question in some ways from one end of it to the other. One of the things that you need to understand, you meaning any human being who's listening to me, is that you're not going to get someone to understand your point of view or take on your position unless they have some interest in doing so, unless they see it as in their interest. And I think I've said in a debate in Toccoa, Georgia recently, that I think you can boil it down to four statements. And I think if those four statements get agreement, that then we have to go from there to separation of government and religion. And those four are things that I think even a fundamentalist will agree with if you give them a chance and if you can get them to listen. Number one, we don't all agree on religion in this country. Americans certainly don't all agree on the truth about what the Almighty God is like, if he exists, whether we should worship him, what he wants us to do. We disagree. Second, humans are fallible. Human judgment, not divine judgment. If there is any such thing as divine judgment, then obviously it's not fallible. But human judgment is fallible. So our understanding of what God wants us to do is necessarily not something we can be sure of. It is not something we can count on. And even the Bible with, things like judge not lest ye be judged and many, many other biblical verses supports this idea that human judgment is fallible, that you have to be careful about what you as a human being conclude about anything, including about what God wants. Third thing, and it's very, very important, religious truth cannot be decided by votes or by force. If, in fact, you have the bigger army or have more votes, that's not going to convince me to convert from Catholicism to Islam or from Islam to Judaism, etc., or to atheism or secular humanism. And finally, that freedom deserves and needs to be protected, especially religious liberty. Now, I think if we make it clear that those are the four, and it doesn't matter whether we use those particular words, but you have to make it clear to a fundamentalist that his or her rights, religious liberty, ability to practice, ability to make judgments about what God wants him or her to do depends directly on accepting religious liberty for everyone else. And by the way, I certainly think that it's possible to imagine, and I have known a couple of what I might call fundamentalist atheists who want to take away the rights of fundamentalist religious. And I don't want that to happen. Much as I oppose Christianity and religions of other sorts and support atheism, I don't want the government to do it. I want the government to stay neutral. And I think it's absolutely crucial that we support secular government. And secular government support does not imply that someone is not religious themselves. There are plenty of religious people who do support secular government.
I'd like to read you something from Sam Harris's book and get your opinion on it.
Okay. Well, first of all, my opinion of Sam Harris's book is wonderful. If you're talking Letter to a Christian.
Yes, yes.
Actually, I'm talking about The End of Faith.
Well, both of them are wonderful books. And they should be read. Now, Baubles of Blasphemy and Fundamentals of Extremism should be read as well. But
yes, the God Delusion. Them, they should be ordered together. Right.
Okay.
You get cheaper shipping. Excellent. That way.
I just want to read a little blurb, and so our audience can hear what you think about this particular little paragraph I'm going to read.
Okay.
While moderation in religion may seem a reasonable position to stake out, in light of all that we have and have not learned about the universe, it offers no bulwark against religious extremism and religious violence. From the perspective of those seeking to live by the letter of the text, the religious moderate is nothing more than a failed fundamentalist. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think he's right, but I think there are plenty of religious folks who wouldn't think he was right. And
yeah,
we have to make allies. We need allies, and I think Sam Harris knows that as well. That doesn't mean we have to say they're right.
But let me try to define religion. To me, religion involves a belief in a supernatural world of some sort. That's my simplest definition. Now, there are lots of people who believe in some aspect of a supernatural world, including traditional Christians who believe in the resurrection of Christ, who are not fundamentalists. Those are not the dangers. The dangers are those that we have been talking about. Now, answer to what Dr. Buckner was saying a moment ago, there are, in fact, a segment of fundamentalists who, known as dominionist or reconstructionist, dominion theology, whose ultimate stated goal is to go back to the biblical laws of the Old Testament in toto. Now, to such people, separation of church and state is, in fact, anathema. There is no separation of church and state, nor should there be, because how can you improve on the perfection of God? If God has ordained it, who are you to say otherwise? Now, my great-great-grandfather, Dr. James Henley Thornwell of South Carolina, wrote extensively on this point at the time of what Dr. Butler would call the War of Northern Aggression.
Right.
And he was advocating that there is, in fact, no separation of church and state. And I was somewhat interested to note that the Dominionists have picked up great-great-granddaddy's writing as a seminal document for their movement. And curiously, they've chosen South Carolina as the place to move to, and they're certainly welcome to do so as long as they let us keep Charleston. yeah, it's dangerous, but not all religious people are alike, nor do we think they are, and I have no quarrel with many religious people. What worries me is that the fundamentalists are gaining in power, and I think this is in direct proportion to the degree that they get frightened. When you are worried about the survival of yourself or your society, it is tempting to look to supernatural solutions. Now, let me say also that the problem may not be fixable. They may cause the collapse of our society, and American society will disappear, as have all great societies and empires of the past. Empires have an average life expectancy of about 200 years. And, you know, I'm not saying it would happen, but it certainly could happen. They simply could destroy society through internecine wars. Look at the example of Easter Island, where a very small little microcosm, where apparently two religious groups totally denuded the island and destroyed the habitation. That could happen on a global scale, especially when you have bigger and better weapons. So that may be what's really at stake here. We either let it all be legal and let live, but you see, we have Muslims claiming that they must prevail over all others, and fundamentalist Christians think the same thing. There's not a nickel's worth of difference between fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims at a base level. It's the same tune. The words are simply different. Yeah, how's that for a nice, scary thought?
I thought we were going to end on, some optimistic notes here.
Well, we can end on an optimistic note. We can, reject this kind of thing. We can do what the founding fathers envisioned. We can quit defiling the graves of our martyrs. We can quit pretending the Constitution says something other than it does. And by the way, there are plenty of people who are trying to rewrite the Constitution, rewrite our historical documents, trying to say that Jefferson did not write the letter he did to the Danbury Baptists, and on and on. Is that not so, Dr. Butler?
It is certainly so, and it is worth noting, and I think Edwin Kagan did in his chapter, and I did in mine, and in our book, The Fundamentals of Extremism. It's really clear that education is important, and that we insist on defending, as the American approach, secular government, and we insist on labeling those who oppose secular government as un-American.
Right. And
they might not go quite as far as Edwin Kagan in declaring a war or declaring that they're involved in a civil religious war, but I'm worried that they might be, and I certainly think we need to defend that and that they're unpatriotic. They're un-American.
Right, and when they want to post the Ten Commandments along with the Mayflower Compact and other irrelevant things, why don't they post the treaty with Tripoli that says in black-letter language that the government of the United States is in no sense founded on the Christian religion, approved by a unanimous Senate and signed by the President of the United States? Now, Dr. Buckner is an expert on that document. But that
we have discussed that at an earlier point when you didn't have.
We have, okay, that's when I was off the phone.
But you're right.
It bears repeating. Okay, why are they not emphasizing that among the historic documents?
Well, clearly because that doesn't make their point.
That's right. If the data doesn't fit the theory, discard the data.
Right. And it's certainly true. I did happen to hear earlier discussion with Edwin Kagan about the Mayflower Compact, and he's right about that in all of the respects that he talked about it. The one thing that he didn't happen to mention, at least this time, Mayflower Compact swore allegiance to the King of England.
Absolutely.
So if that compact is something we have to use as a guide, then obviously we have to throw out the American Revolution.
Yeah, and I believe that was a gay king, was it not? Wasn't that a gay king they were swearing allegiance to?
I think that's right. I would like to hear from my friend and colleague in Charleston, South Carolina, what he thinks about this business of fundamentalist being
Herbert, are you there, Herb?
I'm here. What do you want to hear from me?
Fundamentalists wanting to move to South Carolina. So it's taken over.
Actually, we welcome them here because this state is pretty much of a fundamentalist state to begin with. So if we take all the fundamentalists here, then the other 49 states can have a decent way of living.
Doug Silverman, on that note, I'd like to ask you a few more questions, then I'll actually let you off the line since the last few questions we have are for Edwin and Ed, and I want to hear them go at it like Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. So, but Herb, please tell me about your run for governor in South Carolina and why you chose to run.
Yeah, good question. Why would a liberal, atheist, Yankee Jew with four strikes against me run for the highest office in the land? Or at least in South Carolina. Well, a colleague of mine at the College of Charleston, where I teach, told me that our state constitution prohibited atheists from holding the office of governor. Now, I'm no constitutional scholar like Edwin, but I knew that Article 6 of our U.S. Constitution prohibited religious tests for public office. So I went to the ACLU to ask how this obviously unconstitutional provision could be changed, and he told me the only way that that could happen is if I were a plaintiff as an atheist. So I decided to run for governor. And at the time, the governor then said that our state constitution was fine just as it is, because our nation was founded on godly principles. And that's where the fun began. Because, before this time, and this was in 1990, I was pretty much of an apathetic atheist. It just didn't seem important to me to be an atheist any more than to go around saying I was a round earther. To me, it just seemed like the sensible default position. But when I learned that atheists in South Carolina could not become governor, I became committed to this more as a civil rights issue. It wound up, I got a lot of media attention down here. I was on a number of talk shows, and typically a caller might say, well, as an atheist, I assume you're free to go out and murder and rape and do whatever else you think you can get away with. My response usually was, with an attitude like that, I hope you continue to believe in a God. I quickly learned that I was there to also try to change the hearts and minds of my fellow South Carolinians, as well as to change the Constitution. And also, I'm an educator, and I saw that my campaign was to try to educate the public about discrimination against atheists. And I was in a number of debates, and I, you know, tried to be nice, even trying to make the point that atheists, like anyone else, are just decent human beings. I was often told that atheists have no sense of humor, so I tried at least during these debates to show that I did have one, like when I would typically be asked what's my chance of winning the election, I'd say that, you know, I'm an atheist, I'm not a fool, and what would be the first thing I'd do if I were elected? I'd say something like, demand a recount, because I learned that, it was important to at least change the face of preconceived notions of what an atheist was. And today, I think most people, even in South Carolina, think that atheists should be allowed to hold public office. But I hope to see sometime in my lifetime a day when people actually vote for a well-qualified candidate for public office who happens to be an atheist.
Now, do you think it was because you ran for governor of South Carolina that they decided to turn that into a religious fundamentalist state?
I think it was a religion. I knew we were kind of in the buckle of the Bible Belt. I didn't know quite what that meant until I heard some of the venom of people who felt threatened just because I was an atheist. Because most people seem not to have even known an atheist.
It really bothers them. It scares them. It scares them, doesn't it? They're worried.
They hate generally things that force them to think in direct contradiction to how they've been told their entire life. I mean, it's really hard to admit that your parents lied to you, whether they knew it, they were lying or not. And, you know, that everybody you've loved your entire life has basically believed a lie. It's the biggest conspiracy on earth. So it's a pretty hard thing to accept, and you don't want to accept it. And it's scary, and you want to push it away. So that's the type of emotion that comes out of hearing the word atheist, and it's a shame. In fact, I noticed, Herb, earlier that you used the word non-theist, and we use terms like secular, and we talk about people being bright. Kelly's mentioned bright, and we constantly do all sorts of things to avoid the word atheist. You know, John Suarez earlier was talking about how we're not born atheists, and I didn't exactly really even catch.
Well, he's just plain wrong if you say, I don't think he said that, but
well,
we are born atheists.
I don't know exactly what he's saying, but I almost wonder if he was using the strong atheist definition in that sense. And it's just, there is so much misconception around the word and how fearful people are when they hear the word.
There's a lot of misconception about the word.
One reason with the secular coalition we say non-theist is because we want to be as inclusive as possible to have humanists and atheists and people who just don't believe in a deity and using different terminology.
Exactly.
What we're trying to get involved with, just to show that one does not have to believe in a deity or rewards and punishments in an afterlife in order to be good, decent human beings.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I very much appreciate the inclusiveness of that idea, and I understand why you would do it. And and you would rather work on furthering progress than dealing with this silly semantical argument that comes up all the time about is atheism is a belief and what is it and yada, yada, yada. But the reality is, what you said was that you want to work with different types of humanists, all different types of people that don't believe in a God. And the reality is that all different types of people that don't believe in a God, all of them are atheists. But so many of them call themselves humanist and agnostic and bright. And most of the time they do that because of the fear of the word, the fact that so many people don't even understand what the word is. And so many people think it's a belief, and it's a shame. In fact, you know, the whole notion that agnostic is a position in between atheism and theism is something that we here at the squad consider just as irrational as theism. That idea, it's either ignorance or irrationality, and it's a shame. But from your perspective, from what you're trying to do at the Secular Coalition for America, I think that it's good the way that you guys say non-theist. You avoid the argument and just include everybody. But, you know, it's a shame that you're going to get an agnostic in there who's going to know for sure they're not an atheist, because an atheist is a devil worshiper.
I think a lot of people do understand that they're atheists. They would just rather lead with a different word, because of how the word atheist was demonized. And you know, various organizations or people within organizations would spend so much time and energy debating what's the best word to use. And I feel we should just move forward that changing our culture is more important than trying to settle on the perfect word.
I agree. And in that sense, non-theist is great.
At Camp Quest, which we haven't really talked about, it is the first summer camp for the children of atheists and other non-believers by whatever name. We have a questionnaire at the end of the camp and ask, what have you learned at Camp Quest? One little girl wrote, I have learned that it is okay not to believe in God. I thought this was an extremely significant answer, showing what Camp Quest is really all about. She did not say, I've learned not to believe in God, because we don't teach there is no God. She said she had learned it was okay not to believe in God, and that's all anybody's trying to do. I don't think any of us, any of the authors of the book, are out trying to convert people to atheism, no matter what the bigots may say about us.
Edwin, I want to come back to Camp Quest because it's such an important project. But please, Dr. Silverman, you know, tell us more about the legal battles and the Notary Public.
Well, it almost sounds like a soap opera that I challenged the state constitution with an ACLU lawyer. And I did have my day in court. It was initially the U.S. District Court of South Carolina, where the judge who had been appointed under the recommendation of Strom Thurmond called my case not right, that he wouldn't rule on the merits of the case unless I won the election as governor. So, and that was his way of just throwing it out. And of course, I lost the election. And at that, they thought would be the end of it. But with politics in my blood, the question was, what do I do after running for governor? And that's when I decided to go for my lifelong dream of becoming a notary public. And actually, I found out that I was ineligible for any public office. And I knew I couldn't win dog catcher in South Carolina at this point. So in 1991, my ACLU lawyer found that I was ineligible for every public office, and there was a case in 1961 at the U.S. Supreme Court with Torcaso, pretty much identical to my case, that said that notaries can, that you can have no religious test, and anybody can apply for a notary, which I did in South Carolina, and I filled out the form, paid my $25 fee, only crossed out, so help me God, on the application, and pointed out that the U.S. Constitution prohibits such religious tests. Well, my application was returned by the Secretary of State because I didn't fill out the form properly. And the ultimate decision was the governor, and he rejected my application too. When we asked reasons, he said it would just be too burdensome for him to give reasons for all of his rejections of notary public. Well, in a deposition, and this was now in 1994, the Secretary of State had to admit that they had over 33,000 applications for notary, and I was the only one that was rejected of those 33,000. So it couldn't be too much of a burden. And as far as I can tell, I'm the only person in the history of South Carolina to be rejected as notary public. Well, you know, I don't want to go on too long, but this lasted from 91 to 1997, and then the South Carolina Supreme Court unanimously agreed that the South Carolina Constitution violates the religious test clause of the U.S. Constitution. Only the governor didn't immediately grant me the notary public. He didn't want to be the first governor of South Carolina to acknowledge that an atheist had such rights. But the problem that he had was that if he appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, it would go against the arguments that they had to begin with, namely the states' rights arguments that Ed was talking about, because they said they were sworn to uphold the state constitution without regard to previous U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So how could they then ask the federal government to interfere with the unanimous decision of the highest court in the sovereign state of South Carolina. The other argument was their wasting of taxpayer money because they've spent over $100,000 to keep me from being a notary public. And they were concerned about wasting even more taxpayer dollars on what would obviously be another costly and fruitless appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So finally, they granted me in 1997 my notary commission.
At the cost of $100,000 to the state.
Right. But what was interesting is that the politicians knew that they had no legal case from the beginning. Our lawyers even found out from theirs that they knew that. But at the same time, they would rather waste taxpayer money on a lost cause rather than risk the wrath and lose the votes of a well-organized religious right. And that's what we're trying to fight against.
Well, it's quite some battle, and I'm glad you decided to fight it. What's the stance now? If somebody's a non-believer in South Carolina, can they run or will they suffer the same sort?
Yes. Because overturning this clause, via the notary public means that anybody is allowed to run and hold public office if elected for any office. Now, the next problem is how do we marshal a force that we can have people recognize? And it's not just in South Carolina. In any state in the country, say somebody running for Congress as an acknowledged atheist has essentially no chance of winning. And this is with our secular coalition and trying to change hearts and minds that we're hopefully going to be able to overcome. And this is where the coalition is of non-theists, but also we're getting some liberal religionists on our side also, like people in Americans United for Separation of Church and State who understand our Constitution, that we should have rights, and that there's nothing inherently moral with not believing in a deity. And this is a civil rights battle that we're behind African Americans and gays and other minorities, but this is a priority for us to win.
I'm really glad you're fighting it. In fact, it was mentioned more in the last episode, but once again, Dr. Silverman is the president of the Secular Coalition for America. You can check them out at secular.org. They have a contest right now to help them find the highest ranking government official who is a non-believer, and they're willing to award $1,000 to the person who can find them. So you can submit an entry on their site if you think you know somebody high up in government that doesn't believe in God. And how exactly do they prove that the person was a non-believer? Do they submit some sort of story that they heard, or?
Well, they can submit a story for evidence, but we require more evidence than hearsay. We're not going to be outing anybody, but then we write or contact the person in question and ask if they're willing to confirm that they're an atheist.
See, you said it again. You clearly gave your intentions of trying to convert people.
I've got a sneaky Freudian slip.
No, not convert.
You're trying to convert people to the religion of atheism.
No, what we want to do is ask the person in Congress if they're willing to acknowledge that they're atheists. We know that there are some, but they won't publicly acknowledge it, and we're really hoping to get people to come out of their closets. That's what worked more than anything in the gay rights movement. They used to be thought to be child perverts, but when they started coming out of the closet, we saw they were good and bad atheists, just like they're good and bad Christians, good and bad African Americans, good and bad women. And we want to just be treated based on our actions rather than be demonized because we're atheists.
And with that, we will let you go, and we will wrap the show up with Ed Buckner and Edwin Kagan, and we really appreciate the length of time that you spent with us today. Thanks so much for everything that you've done for our country and everything that you're doing for our country right now. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's not me doing it. We all need to get together and work in a unit to be able to accomplish our ultimate goals to change the culture in our country. And anyone who wants to help us with the Secular Coalition for America at www.secure.org. Please feel free to do so.
And we should talk.
And I thank you for having me.
And we should talk off the air as well, because I'm not sure how and what ways we can help you, but we'd be glad to offer any support we can. So, and,
okay,
you know, including maybe you guys could put together some audio commercials that we could run for free for you in our show from time to time.
Okay, and please check our website that gives some indications on how you can help us. But in part, just being part of our action alerts to tell you what bills are coming up so you can write to your congressman, and then our lobbyists can work with those people, because we need to show that we are a constituency that needs to be reckoned with.
I agree.
And of course, donations are always welcome.
I agree. That's right, people. Go to secular.org. And Dr. Herb Silverman, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As Harry Truman said, it doesn't matter who gets the credit, and we get more done if we don't worry about who gets the credit, but we should give credit to Herb Silverman anyway.
Yeah, that's right. He's certainly a legend and very modest as well. So
not true of me or Edwin, though.
Rosie O'Donnell and others have gotten into trouble for claiming things like radical Christianity is just as threatening as radical Islam in a country like America. Was O'Donnell right?
She was right if you mean radical Christianity is just as dangerous as radical fundamentalism. I don't think there are as many yet, anyway, radical Christians as there are, nor are they in as much power as radical Islamists are in other parts of the world. So far, in this country, thanks to lawyers like Edwin Kagan, we have civil rights and civil liberties for atheists and for people of all religions, and that means that the fundamentalists in this country are not yet as dangerous as fundamentalist Islamists are in the rest of the world.
And yet bills have been introduced into the Congress to reduce the powers of lawyers to do anything about it. And
I understand that. There are serious dangers. I'm not saying that there are not very serious dangers. I'm saying that they are not quite as dangerous yet in this country.
Not yet. Radical
Christians
yet, no.
Are not as dangerous as Islamists are in Pakistan, say.
That's quite correct. But I think in their foundational documents, if they are interpreted in a fundamentalist manner, that the writings of the Old Testament are every bit as draconian as the writings of Islam. Now, there are
absolutely
Islamic, Islamic
no
scholars.
No question about that.
Right. See, Islamic scholars are willing to say, that there is another way of looking at it other than the fundamentalist ways, just as more liberal Christians are willing to say that. And that's what needs to be encouraged. That's not a problem. It's when someone thinks that we can go to war over whose God can beat up who else's God that we have the problem.
I agree.
Edwin, your father was a Presbyterian minister, right?
That is correct, yes.
How religious were you as a child, and what led you away from religion?
Oh, I was quite religious. I had 12 years of perfect church attendance in Sunday school. I was a believer. I wanted to be a minister like everyone in my family back to John Knox had been. And then they made the mistake of sending me to college. People have asked me how I learned as much as I do know about the Bible. And I said, 12 perfect years of Sunday school attendance. They said, why did you become an atheist? I said, 12 perfect years of Sunday school attendance. I finally started to think about it. Now, am I brighter than anyone else? No, not really, I don't know what the difference is. I have often thought that there may be in some people a religious gene, a need. In fact, I think there's been a book written on that or some empirical evidence. There may be certain people who are programmed by genetics to be more believers than others. And it would make some sense that the people who stayed behind the caves with the shamans or the religious leaders are likely to be more protected, while the more adventurous, non-conforming types, such as Dr. Buckner and I, might have gone out and explored and gotten hit by a saber-toothed tiger and our genes eliminated from the gene pool. And I think that's a very real possibility. But yes, I was very much a believer. I know the system. I know what they think. I will say that my father was not a fundamentalist. He believed in evolution, or rather accepted evolution. Evolution isn't something you believe in or not. It is something you learn, such as the multiplication table. And he was not a fundamentalist. He didn't believe the Ark story or the Adam and Eve story, but he was of a authoritarian bent, to be sure. His father was born in Germany, and that's all you need to know about that.
How about you, Dr. Buckner? You grew up the son of a minister as well, right?
Yeah, very similar story in many ways. My father was a low church Episcopalian. I was president of the church youth group and sang in the church choir, which is astonishing because I can't carry a tune about burkas or anything else. And I was an acolyte and what have you, so I was certainly a religious kid, at least outwardly, and said I was going to be a minister until I was off to college. So my story in many ways is similar to Edwin's. I'm better looking than he is.
Yeah, I think, well, that's the best, you know, that, whatever. At any rate, listen, we both have nice wives. That's the amazing thing. I don't know how the most frequently asked question of both of our wives is, how do you put up with them?
True enough.
You know, there is a certain anger, at least I experienced a certain anger that took a number of years to deal with, when you realize that this whole thing is not so. That you have been lied to, maybe not deliberately, but nonetheless lied to about this, as you were deliberately lied to about Santa Claus. I see a true analogy there. It's something that you can overcome. It really is. And this is the good message, I think, that can be given out, that you don't have to continue to be slaves to it. You can survive.
Edwin, I don't know if you know, we haven't had the chance to talk about it yet, but
okay.
I'm a huge, like, gigantic fan of Camp Quest and what you guys are doing.
Oh, thank you.
There's a Camp Quest that they're trying to form right now in Philadelphia, and I've agreed.
I know about that. They've contacted me.
Yeah.
I suggested they have me come out and talk to them. Okay.
Well, that's good. I mean, I'll have to make sure I get together with you when you come into town.
Yes. Because, are you in Philadelphia?
Yes. And
oh, okay. Well, have me come up and we can have a radio show and set you up at Camp Quest Philadelphia. My Helen and I have retired from this project after having initiated it and done it for 10 years. And so now we just want to go around doing things like setting up Camp Quest Riviera, Camp Quest Maui, Camp Quest, you know, that kind of thing. It's tough work, but somebody's got to do it. And
Camp Quest Eiffel Tower. And
yeah, right. There is a Camp Quest Michigan, Camp Quest Minnesota, Camp Quest Canada and near Ontario, and a Camp Quest California, Camp Quest Smoky Mountains. I'm quite pleased with that.
Yeah, and in fact...
And it's,
go ahead,
it's been attacked on the Colbert Report, too.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, the Colbert Report put us on. They said they showed our logo in Camp Quest and said then had this wonderful graphic of our campers spending eternity canoeing on a lake of fire. I liked it so much. We liked it so much, we sent them a copy of my book and a Camp Quest T-shirt. To Brother Colbert.
Brother Colbert. And I actually posed some thoughts. I'm friends with some of the guys who are trying to start the Camp Quest in Philly.
Okay.
And
tell them we ought to bring Edwin and Helen there to talk, and that's what we'll teach them how to do it.
I've okay. also, I mean, hey, however, whatever we got to do, you know, I've given them some ideas and some thoughts. I don't know if you're aware, but we started a site called freethinkingteens.com. Did you?
No, I'm not aware of that. I would be very interested in being involved in anything like that. Something like that is a automatic referral of both campers and potential staff.
Yeah, sure. And in fact, we want to work that site closely with other organizations like yours. We're already trying to form a good alliance with the Secular Student Alliance. And
right. I'm told. Yes. Oh, I'm on their advisory board, as I believe is Dr. Buckner. People say, what can we do? There may not be anything we can do. We may go down the tubes of history, but we're not going to go down without a fight. And one way to fight back is with Camp Quest, with the children who are our only future. I have looked on Camp Quest as a night light in a dark and scary room. And we have had kids at Camp Quest cry and say to us that this was the first time they'd been able to share their feelings, their disbelief. They're laughed at and mocked in their schools. And they are strengthened by the Camp Quest experience. At Camp Quest, we have two invisible unicorns and a prize of a godless $100 bill for any camper who can prove they aren't there. And when campers go back to their schools and are told, well, can you prove there's no God? They say, be happy to after you prove there are no invisible unicorns. And the parents have reported that they have been strengthened, and that makes it all worthwhile.
Edwin, you should probably tell them about the vast salary that you pay to the counselors, too.
Oh, yes, yes. No staff is paid, and they ought not, and no Edwin is paid, or Helen. And everybody gets to Camp Quest on their own. Now, try to match that with anything else. The dedication of the staff to do this, there are people who come from across the country at their own expense just to be on staff free at Camp Quest. We have two doctors. We probably have more PhD, more educated people than any of the host camps. Whereas they maybe have a nurse drop in every few days, we have two physicians, one an emergency room physician on the staff. And it's a marvelous experience. Come out and visit. And let's get one started in Philadelphia. It's a beautiful place near Valley Forge, perhaps.
Yeah, and I've had some ideas. I've had some ideas too, and I talked to the guys in Philly, and I thought that maybe you guys would want to do it on a national level. But we've been working with our teens to try to start a podcast of teens, you know, by teens, for teens. And, that's kind of the idea with freethinkingteens.com. The site is actually, as close as we can get to a democracy where we find teens that are worthy of a leadership position and put them in a leadership position, and they effectively run the site. We just pay for the hosting and get them set up with a foundation.
You can have a Camp Quest set up democratically if you want. I know several people doing that. When I was director of Camp Quest, there were two basic rules of Camp Quest. Rule one, Edwin is always right. Rule two, if Edwin is wrong, see rule one. And things just ran swimmingly that way. The worst injury we had was a scraped knee, and so, you know, things went quite well. Democracy in cases like that can be like a camel is a cow put together by a committee. But if you really want to do it, that's fine. You might direct anyone interested to my website at www.edwinkagan.com, edwinkagin.com, and to the section on Camp Quest. There are forums, there are talks given, the challenges given to campers each of the 10 years we were there, and also a document I put together called the Camp Quest Canons. It's basically a little handbook for how to start a Camp Quest. This, in conjunction with Edwin and Helen coming and talking with you, should be adequate to get you going.
And tell the listeners right now just a little bit more about Camp Quest and the types of activities that you do and things like that.
Well, we started it in 1996. I am an Eagle Scout. And I was absolutely outraged when the Boy Scouts said they wouldn't admit those dirty little atheist children. So I thought, why don't we start a camp for secular kids? And I brought this idea to the Free Inquiry Group of Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, and they hosted the first Camp Quest, which was rented from a Southern Baptist campground. We stayed there 2 years, and then various things happened. Summarized in my essay on Baptists and beer, to be found in Baubles of Blasphemy, which hopefully your readers will overwhelm Editor Buckner with, so he has to go into a second printing to get all of the orders filled.
There are other things about Camp Quest in that book as well, of course.
Oh, yes, yes, there is quite a bit about Camp Quest. There is an introduction by Tom Flynn, editor of Free Inquiry magazine, about the starting of Camp Quest. We've got some stories on Tom Flynn, too, but there are quite a few things in there about Camp Quest.
The back of the book is an amazing testament to Edwin Kagan's ability to unite all of the organizations of any significance in the entire country that deal with atheism, secular humanism, etc. Because
well, the trick there was to keep Camp Quest free of the control of any of the groups. We ultimately made from FIG, having run it for a number of years, finally with the permission of FIG, we had it become a national organization's own right, a nonprofit corporation. And all of the various Camp Quests that have been started have also been nonprofit corporations operating roughly along the Camp Quest model. What we do there is what every other camp does. We have riding, horseback riding, swimming, searching for fossils, crafts, making lanyards, archery, fire making, all kinds of things. But we also have little talks at the meals, with, laminated posters of famous free thinkers telling these kids their heritage, that they're not alone. We have, campfires. We emphasize reason and critical thinking. We have courses in evolutionary biology. One year we made a outline Noah's Ark on the ground to let the kids see just how big it was according to the biblical dimensions. Another year we built a crop circle and called the media to tell them about it. All kinds of things. We go on field trips. When the Answers in Genesis Museum of Nonsense opens in Northern Kentucky next year, I think that the local Camp Quest ought to have a field trip there and let the children see what they have to say.
Edwin, there's a ridiculous charge laid at Camp Quest from time to time. And you've already answered it for anyone who's capable of reading between the lines in several different ways. But, you know, feel free to lay into these people now that would say that Camp Quest is like a Jesus camp, and in the sense that it's brainwashing kids.
Well, I do hope that Lynn Zanger of the Camp Quest Department of Copyright Violations is hearing this, because we have hours of video that refute that. Our kids aren't going into trances and crying on the ground and engaging in glossolalia, speaking in tongues, and generally acting psychotic. They are happy. They are upbeat. They are singing. On my website, I told you about, we have a news story by ABC News and several newspapers that interviewed these kids, and it's simply not true. We don't indoctrinate anybody about anything. Actually, some press person asked if one of our campers, do they try to teach you there is no God here? And the kid says, no, the kids coming here already know that, which I thought was a splendid
answer. And in reference to what you guys talk about pertaining to God belief or lack of God belief, what sorts of issues do you discuss and how do you guys approach them? Because that would be the area where Christians would level some sort of charge at you.
People can level all kinds of charges when they don't know what they're talking about. But we,
I agree, by the way.
Yeah, we have talks on different religions, comparative religions, on the nature of myth, on whether there is a supernatural world, and we have the two invisible unicorns, okay? And we have the godless $100 bill as a prize for any camper who can prove they aren't there. Now, this prize has not yet been claimed, and probably will not be. And we talk to them about how the invisible and the non-existent can look much the same. We also have an opportunity to tell them just why this is a godless $100 bill and compare it with. We even give them godless $1 bills that are in little cellophane envelopes, which have been donated by a very fine benefactor. Cost a little more than a dollar now, and they're getting more expensive because, if you'll pardon me, they're not making any more of them, sadly. But we let them know that the In God We Trust was not there during the years of our country. It came in about 1954 or so. And that somehow we managed to survive two world wars and various other things without it. And if you must ascribe causation and causality to things that are not, you could note that we only lost our first war and have had all the problems that we've had after In God We Trust was put on the money and after Under God was put in the pledge. Maybe God is not happy about that. Maybe if the mythological system is true, they consider it a violation of the third commandment. Second, if you're Roman Catholic, to not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. So those are the kind of things that we do. And we also do tell some Bible stories and discuss them. You can have some pretty scary Bible stories taught to kids. Fred Edwards, who is one of the counselors, tells some very nice Bible stories. And we have Fred and Ed's Bible discussion group. We have a library we've created where the kids can check out books and read them. We have a chess tournament. We do not have any indoctrination whatsoever. For the past couple of years, our emergency room physician has been giving a segment on death and dying and what is death and how does it work from a secular perspective. We have had magicians come. We've done all kinds of things.
Do they show you how they do the magic tricks, by the way, or do they just do the magic?
A few of them, they may show one or two, but they will never show the really good ones. And nor should they. But they do let us know that this is happening in the real world. And we show them illusions and show how you can be deceived about things. And if this be indoctrination, so be it. But it's not indoctrination, it's education.
Right.
We do not indoctrinate.
I suppose when it comes time to tell scary stories around the campfire, rather than talk about the escaped mental patient with the hook for a hand, can tell.
No, we don't tell those kind of stories, nor do we sing. No. You know, those would really terrify you. Nor do we sing Kumbaya. You know, we don't do it. But we do. We also have a talent show. Oh, and the first night of camp, the director, in the case of our camp, me, Edwin, gives to the campers a set of challenges, one different one to each cabin to be worked on all week and reported on to the entire camp on the last night of camp. For some years, we've been communicating with a planet that's been discovered known as Questarion, where the inhabitants of Questarion have requested from the campers of Camp Quest information on whether or not their society should proceed along the lines of faith as the priests wish or along the lines of reason and inquiry as others say. And we have been sending answers back to them through a wormhole that happens to open on the last night of camp for about an hour.
It's funny.
Isn't that neat?
Definitely, definitely.
And then we do things like dissect sharks and so on. And
there you go. So, folks, check out Camp Quest and send your kids to a Camp Quest.
Poison Ivy is. Yeah, Camp Quest. Camp Quest. CAMP-QEST.org.
Okay, Camp
or
Quest.
Just Edwin from EdwinKagan.com. From there you can see Camp Quest, various Edwinian blasphemies, and also even order a copy of Bobble the Blasphemy, edited by Dr. Edward Butner, waiting on the line to talk.
That's right. In fact, I have a question for Ed. You propose a commitment to a secular government as a solution, yet fundamentalists of every religion seem highly resistant to such a commitment. What's to be done about that?
Well, as we said in the last chapter of the book and in other places in the book, there aren't any easy answers. There is no way you can't go and shake the fundamentalists by the lapel and get them to accept this. I don't have any illusions. What we have to do is education, whether it's sending kids to Camp Quest to get educated or encouraging grown-ups to read and to think. And, of course, we have to educate fundamentalists themselves on the crucial nature of the protection of religious liberty for their religious liberty. Too many people who think separation of church and state or religion and government is a matter of protecting atheist or protecting weirdos. And it's not. It's a matter of protecting everybody. If you don't want the government to make a religious decision for you, and that's you, whether you're a fundamentalist or an atheist or whoever you are, then you have to support religious liberty. You have to support a secular government, one that does not get involved in making religious decisions for any of her citizens. It's not easy, but we got to keep plugging away at it.
Edwin, what should we do as the head of American Atheists for Kentucky? What do we do?
What should we do? We should send kids to Camp Quest. We should start other. We should do something. You know, we can either sit around and whine while our rights go down the tubes, or we can do something. We've got to quit being afraid.
There you have it. How do you think television has affected fundamentalism in America?
Oh, it's had it's been a vehicle for its conveyance. There have been what have been called two great awakenings in this country. One was around the time of the founding with lunatics like Jonathan Edwards, fundamentalists, and then another one started in the around the Civil War and kept going well into the 20s. A second great awakening, and President Bush has suggested we might now be in a third great awakening. It might well be right. But with television came the national associations of televangelists, and they were much quicker to utilize TV than the more established denominations, and did. And things like the Jim and Tammy Show, Jerry Falwell, the famous Jimmy Swigert, all of these people, Benny Hinn, who lays hands on people and they fall down and who claims miracle cures that are fraudulent. And he can sue me on that, and truth is a defense. They cannot prove a single miracle cure. It's had an enormous effect, and it's culminated more recently in the mega churches that you see cropping up all over the place. Some of these mega churches, like the one in Louisville, Kentucky, have twice as many members in the one church alone as American Atheists. So it's curious that they are so frightened. And what I think they're frightened of is the idea. It is so important to them that everyone believe or else they might be wrong. So it is very threatening to them for someone to get up on their high heels and say, no, I don't believe in a God. It just, they can't handle it.
I think the internet has to some extent counterbalanced this.
That is correct. Although I think the fundamentalists got to jump on it before we did. I really do.
Well,
they're up, yeah, they're certainly on the internet as well. But, you know, I'll tell you what, I think, well, with the exception of Razor, I believe everybody in this room came to, you know, their, you know, to be able to embrace the word atheism, to understand non-belief, to understand who we were, and to really channel into the thoughts that we already kind of had starting in, for atheism. That's all on the internet.
Okay. And let me suggest also, if we're really going to try to change minds and so on, that we should avoid a lot of sarcasm and snide remarks, or, you know, or vulgar bumper stickers. All that does is turn people off. It's not really good dialogue. That's something I've been wanting to say, you know.
Go ahead. What have we said that was snide?
Oh, nothing. I'm just saying as a general principle. I wasn't saying anybody was doing it. I'm just stating a philosophic principle. But,
well, I think we get near the edge of that, or if we don't, you know, actually get there from time to time. But I mean,
well,
you know, to
I
some degree.
Look, I understand the motivation because one is angry. They want to, sound off. They want to outrage them. But you know, bumper stickers like pissing off the religious right or things like that are counterproductive in my view.
On the other hand, you should read many poems and bits of Baubles of Blasphemy, which, according to some people, is just that sort of thing. Now,
I think Edwin
is right that we should not intentionally piss people off. That doesn't do any good. It is counterproductive.
But
I also think that ridicule is a wonderful tool.
Used in the right way,
it is not only desirable, but actually necessary.
I agree absolutely, but I don't think you'll be hard-pressed to find a dirty Anglo-Saxon word in Baubles of Blasphemy, Sir Editor.
So you think it's the language specifically, using a curse word or something like that?
Yes, in some cases I do. Some people can't see through the language and are so turned off. but I like to use their own kind of language, like read the gospel according to Thaddeus in Bibles of Blasphemy and some other things, and the Revelation to Edwin, which is written in the same style as the Revelation to John, the last chapter, the last book of the Bible. Ridicule is wonderful. I think they should be ridiculed. I defined blasphemy something like the crime of making fun of ridiculous beliefs others hold sacred.
Okay, so let me get to the bottom of the what you're proposing. It's bad language that we should not take part in.
I think that's essentially correct. Yes.
Now, is it context?
In your attack.
Is it context and how it's used, or is it like if I say I dislike that fucking Jesus camp, or if I said all Christians are fucking stupid. They're clearly two separate entirely things.
I think that's a mistake.
Well, is the first any better than the second?
I think it's the use of the expletive that is
to even have it at all. But don't you think? Don't you think to some degree? Because I argue that there's no such thing as a bad word. There's merely.
Well, I argue that same thing too. But there are other contexts in which you can do it.
Okay. Well, but to some degree, don't you think that merely calling religion irrational, which a claim I can back up, theism irrational? Don't you think to some degree that's just as distasteful as using a curse word?
Oh, absolutely. But it doesn't have the same kind of emotional impact on people.
You have to understand that Edwin Kagan is 107 years old.
That's right. That's right. And I am basically a very conservative type of person.
It's an NRA instructor, for example.
I'm an NRA instructor. Yeah, that's right. And you have to decide what's the most important. Do you want to push for the use of various Anglo-Saxon terms, which I'm all in favor for and will use freely in other contexts? Or are you trying to persuade people that their belief in a supernatural deity is harmful to themselves and small children and society in general?
Well, I think actually you missed a third option. We're trying to do a little bit of persuading people, but to some degree, we're trying to make them realize that there's a reason to be persuaded. We understand that we're not necessarily going to be the persuaders. There are other people out there.
I do understand that. What I'm suggesting is that the language could make a barrier that they will not get past to go on to the more profound statements you're making.
See, I think I think when you start limiting yourself like that, you have to limit yourself in so many other areas. Seriously, to call theism irrational every time, no matter what type of theism, even deism, irrational.
We
call it that based on the fact that you believe in something without proof. To call it that, I mean, we get people that write us about that charge all the time. And they don't, they haven't listened to the show, so they haven't heard expletives. We enjoy the fact that we're free on internet radio to use any word we want.
Well, that's fine.
But I mean, that aside, I think that people do find and there's plenty of other examples, but calling theism irrational, or you started with a blasphemous quote about, Mary,
I said that she was a deranged hooker. I didn't say she was a bloody fucking cunt,
he would never use language like that.
I don't think there's that much of a difference, though, is what I'm saying.
You need to figure it out.
107.
Right.
I think it, to some degree if they're going to be turned off, they're not necessarily. I don't know. I don't think that the word really does it, but I guess maybe I'm just naive, or maybe you're 107. I don't know.
Well, no, I think that it definitely can affect people, especially if your goal is to reach people, you want to be able to, appeal to like a wider audience, and it's not necessarily always your personal opinion or a matter of like limiting yourself. For example, the Jesus fish, little plaque thing that has the Darwin fish,
Ass-raping it?
Jesus fish.
May I know who this brilliant young woman is speaking? Who is
this? Is Kelly. This is our philosopher and psychologist.
Hello, Kelly. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. But anyway, I may find that thing personally to be amusing or even, correct or whatever. But if I put that on my car, I realize that people are just going to look at that and be like, one of those heathens.
That's right.
And I'm going to go pray for your immortal soul.
I agree with that. But that's not exactly like our show, curse words and things like that. And, calling theism irrational is embedded within a different context.
show all you want. I'm talking about the bumpers where you're trying to, you know, I don't think you're going to find too many of the religious right tuning into your thing, except the ordinary usual suspects, fundamentalist spies are everywhere. They're taping you. And
I'll
getting
tell
your
you
number
what I
for
think.
Homeland
all right,
Security.
Well, let's analyze.
I think you should wind up. I think you should wind up the show. Related on a very high note, related to this discussion about offending people and so forth, by having Edwin sing Back in Their Burkas Again, a song
that
he wrote.
No, that would be too offensive to anyone. You can check with my Back in Their Burkas Again, women obeying their men. No other men should ever see an eyebrow or a knee. They're back in their burkas again. Read Bibles of Blasphemy, available on Amazon.com. Ed Buckner, editor. Oh, and the Fundamentals of Extremism. Be sure to get that. Get them in tandem.
Well, as Lord Ed Buckner proclaimed, we are wrapping up the show with the burka song. And you can purchase
the most enjoyable evening of my life. Yes.
In the Bubbles of Blood. There you go. And you know, and I'm going to use that as one of our little quotes that we put in the New York Times, you know, under
Absolutely.
It's going to say, you know, it's one of the most enjoyable evenings of my life, Edwin Kagan. So.
That's right. And it's Kelly like older men, you know.
I believe she does, although I think 103 is her cutoff.
Well, you know what, George, Groucho Marx said, a man is only as old as the woman he feels. So.
Terrible.
Oh, jeez.
Isn't that awful? Okay.
All right,
I'm offending them now.
Well, gentlemen, it was a pleasure having you on this roundtable show, and we've got to get each of you on the show in the future. And Edwin, when you come into town for Camp Quest, we're going to have you in. And I already talked to the guys. We're gonna do a lot of promotion for Camp Quest.
We're going to sit there, and we'll have lots of press, and we'll have a wonderful time, okay?
Yes, definitely, definitely. So don't forget to check out our sponsors, EvolveFish.com. Visit us at RationalResponders.com, AskTheAtheist.com, FreeThinkingTeens.com, and Christmas.com. And until next time, folks, stay rational.
Word.